Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and this is the Zero Point Radio Show through BBS Radio. It is Saturday, December 10th, 2011. I'm coming to you from Ottawa, Canada, or at least close to that. I actually live south of Ottawa. And my co-host, James Moffat, is coming from Toronto, Ontario. Hi, Jim. How are you?
Good. How are you, Chris?
Okay, good. We had mentioned last week we were going to talk about the movie Thrive this week, but unfortunately, for different reasons, Jim hasn't really had time to kind of review that movie and had other family things going on. His brothers had some emergency health problems, and it's kind of confounded your life a bit, hey Jim? I hope your brother Dougie is doing well and seems to be recovering as well as can be, eh?
Yeah, under the circumstances, I guess he's pretty lucky to be alive, and we just have this weird family history of these brain aneurysms. So, so far so good. He's made quite a remarkable recovery. I think he's way ahead of what everybody expected, and it's difficult for me because I'm 250 miles away, but I think more difficult for my family who's there because, they're at the hospital all the time. But so far so good. I mean, the big thing, he's not paralyzed and he's able to speak, which was the biggest fear. That was quite miraculous that he's actually already spoken, because it was in his speech area that the aneurysm occurred. So.
Wow, that's excellent.
It's very, very encouraging.
I think of my poor mom. Over 10 years ago.
I know.
Hasn't been able to speak for 10 years.
Wow. Yeah,
even though she has mental comprehension. It's sad. It's very frustrating to her at times. But I always thought it would come back a little bit more, but it never did.
Yeah, I'm surprised it hasn't with her, because I was talking to another friend of mine who has a friend who had a stroke 3 years ago, a younger guy, and he regained his speech to a certain extent, but he was very frustrated because, he really couldn't express himself, and it was very difficult for him. He had a lot of word-finding problems, and articulation problems. I mean, as there are a myriad of things in terms of, speech deficits that can occur, and so we'll see where it goes for Doug. But the fact that he can speak at all is kind of it's encouraging, because at least he has a baseline where he's already indicated that he can speak to some extent. So,
exactly, yeah.
It's amazing the brain's plasticity in terms of its capacity to recover its functioning and other areas to take over is really quite remarkable. So we're kind of hoping for that, too. And there was a fear that he would be paralyzed, at least temporarily, but he's got full movement in both his limbs. So it's very, very encouraging, but kind of a nice shock to remind you of,
the inevitability of death, as Jeff mentioned.
Time is precious and it's meaningful, we have to make the most of what we do with this planetary existence, and try to do our best. I saw a very, by the way, just I saw the second half of the documentary that Martin Scorsese did on George Harrison called Living in the Material World, which was aired on HBO, and I saw the first part about a month ago, and I taped the second part, but I've never had a chance to kind of watch it. I didn't kind of care for the first part all that much. I was a bit disappointed, but found the second part to be very, very interesting. It dealt a lot with his spiritual outlook and very interesting documentary on, because he was sort of the kind of such an interesting contradiction, paradox himself, because he was materially so successful and such a big pop star and everything, and the biggest in the world, but it didn't really mean anything to him, and he really led the second half, more than the second half of his life, trying to prepare to die as consciously as possible, and very interesting to hear his perspective on things. And
At one point, Harrison joined the Hare Krishna movement, eh?
Well, he attended their temple, and they interviewed some Hare Krishnas in the, and he really, really loved chanting. And he and John Lennon, at one point, they got this recording from the Hare Krishna temple in Los Angeles, and they played it, and then they started playing, and they played for like 10, 12 hours, and he said at one time he chanted for like 3 days straight. He said, you know, it's just... just so blissful, you know, that the activity. It was very interesting hearing him, and of course he had a deep interest in Indian music and, you know, more spiritual music. So, yeah, it was a lot of different aspects of it. It's just like he just struck me as such an interesting character in a sense that he had it all in terms of what it means to make it in the West, and yet he thought it was kind of ridiculous and really insubstantial and didn't really satisfy what his own kind of quest and his own, what he felt his life mission was, you know. And so it was it was quite inspiring, his whole perspective on things. I really liked the documentary. I'd recommend people see it, you know. It's a different take on...
And Scorsese, amazing that he did that.
Well, he did one about Bob Dylan's first 5 years of his career at No Direction Home, which was really good, very, very interesting. And now he's done this one. And it was interesting because, you know, the obvious choices are Lennon or McCartney's, but, you know, Harrison is equally as interesting a person in some ways, I think, more interesting than the other two, you know, so...
I like that song when he came out, I think, with his first double album.
Right.
And he had one song on there which would go into the Hare Krishna mantra. It was really nice.
Yeah.
My Sweet Lord, I think it was called.
It was a huge,
nice.
Huge hit for him. And, and he also got sued for plagiarism because it's the song itself is basically the Crystal song, He's So Fine, which Phil Spector did in the 50s.
Oh, yeah,
and
okay.
Phil Spector actually produced that, which is so weird that they didn't seem to realize that, hey, you know, this is the same song. But, yeah, because they went
Phil
to Hare.
Phil Spector produced it?
Yeah. They went to the Hare Krishna, Hare Lama.
And he had produced it, the earlier version?
He had produced the Crystal song. I think it's the Crystal.
Well, that's funny.
Yeah, it's very peculiar, actually. And, I mean, anybody from that vintage of rock and roll knows that song. Like, I mean, these guys probably played it a billion times. It's amazing that they didn't seem to realize that, hey, you know that's the same song? Because I remember this friend of mine who was a DJ played it the first time. He said, hey, that's a direct rip-off of the Crystals.
Yeah,
but it did have the Hare Krishna, Hare Lama chorus, it's really cool actually seeing some of the footage of them performing that at the concert for Bangladesh, a lot of his songs are very interesting. I mean, he has that song on Sgt. Pepper's, Within You, Without You.
I'm not sure. I can't quite remember.
Which has a sitar. Well, you should listen to the lyrics to that song. It's very interesting. And,
mm-hmm.
Yes, but,
I watched an interesting video which was called Dark Side of the Moon. And in this video, they maintain that Stanley Kubrick, the producer of
2001,
that he was the one who faked the moon, that the recording of the astronaut stepping onto the moon. And, like, where he says, first step for man or something, giant leap for mankind. I'm not sure the exact words.
Yeah.
This movie maintains that was filmed by Kubrick in London, England, again, the name of the studio, because he was finishing up the Space Odyssey at that time. And Nixon, actually, they wanted to produce this stepping onto the moon and those dramatic moments, supposedly in case there was any problem when the event actually occurred. But that's what this movie maintained, that it was actually done by Kubrick in his London studio at the time when he was set up to produce Space Odyssey. So it's a fascinating movie called Dark Side of the Moon, and I don't really know enough to really evaluate those claims. You know, I do believe that the major shots of the moon landing, I believe, are faked. But
that doesn't necessarily mean
that they didn't.
Yeah, well, that guy who did the analysis, I think I sent you that link, looked at all of the photographs, and I don't see it, but, you know, like, I mean, in the big scheme of things, I think it's kind of like, you know, who cares in a way, but I mean, I don't believe it. I mean, I do believe that they did land, and you know, I mean, wouldn't put them past it though to do something like that. Like, well, if things go wrong, we could always, you know, we could always pretend that we did it. You know, like, I mean, that wouldn't surprise me at all.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an interesting question. I mean, it is important, but I mean, it's just another one of those unsolved enigmas that we never get to the root of. Like, you know,
last month
was the Kennedy. You know, we revisit the Kennedy assassination every year, and it's like the masses of people now realize it was some type of conspiracy. But I think people despair of the truth ever being known.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that is important when you can have a coup d'etat and overthrow the government by assassinating the president. I think that's kind of important.
and
that is what happened in my estimation.
I think
the whole argument about Kennedy and whether or not Lee Harvey Oswald did it is completely idiotic. It's clear that he didn't do it. And I think anybody with a brain who looks at it with an open mind can't help but come to that conclusion that there was more than one person shooting at him, and it certainly wasn't Lee Harvey Oswald. So that started to divert attention from the real question: is who benefited? Why did it happen? You know, and I mean, as much as there are flaws in his presentation, for sure, I think, you know, Oliver Stone took all sorts of flack for JFK about how it was historically inaccurate and everything, but it's actually, I think, much closer to his version. I think is much closer to the truth of what happened. I think it was a coup d'etat by elements of the military and the CIA and probably big business in the United States.
Yeah.
And I think they did overthrow the government.
Yeah. I mean, Kennedy was doing so many things simultaneously that could have earned that for him. Like,
well,
he
was going to be assassinated. He spoke about it quite openly. Yeah, and there's a movie.
Wow.
There was a movie made by John Frankenheimer called 7 Days in May, based on the novel. And can't remember the novelist, but it's two guys. But with Burt Lancaster and Kirk Douglas, where a guy in the military tries to overthrow the government. And Kennedy learned that they wanted to shoot scenes outside the White House because there's scenes in the movie of the picketers picketing the White House. And he was very enthusiastic about cooperating with them to make the movie. He felt he was going to be assassinated, and he did feel there could be a coup d'etat. He's like, that's clearly on the record. It's a very good book by David Talbot, who is an editor and writer for Slate, that called Brothers, about the Kennedy assassination. It came out a few years ago. There's been a bunch of recent books that are all really good. I really think that book is very, very good. I think it really sort of puts things in perspective. I think there's other ones that go into other aspects, but it's like, you know, if you can get away with that, you can pretty much get away with anything. That's the way I look at it, you know. And as I say, the whole thing about Oswald, I think, is completely a dodge, you know, and like, it just distracts attention. It's like, it's similar to the situation about trying to figure out whether or not the near-death experience is real or not. That's not the question. It's clearly real, you know, and it's not explicable in the terms of the current situation. It's the wrong question to ask. It's not whether or not it's real. It's like, what's happening here? And that's the way I look at the Kennedy assassination and the Martin Luther King assassination and the Bobby Kennedy assassination and the Malcolm X assassination. I think there's elements in all of them that really indicate that something much deeper is going on, much more profound and important than whether or not some low nut, quote unquote, shot somebody. You know, I think that's completely silly.
Yeah.
Oswald,
I mean, it's a
character in and of himself, too. So.
Sorry?
Oswald was an incredibly interesting character in and of himself.
Mm-hmm,
I mean,
that's
the funny thing about, to me, what's come out of my studies of the Kennedy assassination is that I didn't really, and I've studied this for like 35, 40 years, but it wasn't until like the last 15 or 20 years that I really realized how completely crazy the political situation was at that point in the United States.
Oh.
And the effects of the Cold War and the Cuban Missile Crisis and the Bay of Pigs, like Bay of Pigs basically sealed Kennedy's fate, but Cuba really sealed his fate, I think. I think that's, you know, the Cuban Missile Crisis. But if you really look
opposing
at that,
the military industrial complex.
You know, if I was Kennedy, I would have taken Curtis LeMay was head of Strategic Air Command. I would have taken him out in the front lawn of the White House, and I'd have shot him for insubordination. I mean, they were completely, the Joint Chiefs of Staff and LeMay were completely hostile and openly hostile to the president. And the president is the commander in chief in the United States. The last time I checked, you know. He gets to make the calls. They didn't get elected. He did, you know. And they were completely. Have you ever seen that movie? That's a good movie, actually, based on Bobby Kennedy's book, 13 Days, that was made a few years ago about the Cuban Missile Crisis. Like, it's all on the American side, which is unfortunate. But I wish there'd been more about the Russians, what was going on there. But it's quite good, actually, because it shows like this hostility. Like very openly, and a lot of it's taken verbatim. Like it's not a script that was created. It's actually verbatim conversations that were recorded. So very very interesting. But again, as I say, you have to sort of place everything surrounding the Kennedy assassination in terms of the Cold War and the 50s, and then the early 60s with the Bay of Pigs and then the Cuban Missile Crisis, then the development of the Vietnam War and fighting in the Far East. You know, it's very disturbing. And I would put that in the context of how the hydrogen bomb was developed without any participation by the American public or any involvement in determining whether or not we're going to have these weapons. Like, they were just foisted on people by a very small elite group of people who were in the military-industrial complex, and there were all sorts of scientists who were opposed to it and all sorts of, like, really deep questions about whether or not, you know, we should go ahead and develop this weapon. And it was basically, the decision was just taken out of the hands of everybody and made very perfunctorily and by a very small elite of people. It's very disturbing what happened there.
We have a disturbing history. You know, that's how I see it. Our nations have been hijacked in a way. It's really quite tragic. You know?
I think I see it more as like it's gotten much, much worse since the Second World War. It's like Gore Vidal says that the United States became the national security state. And, you know, Eisenhower, when he was leaving, warned the American people of the military-industrial complex. He actually wanted to say the military-industrial congressional complex, because Congress is the one that, you know, passes the laws and authorizes the spending of this money. But there's a very good documentary about that, called Why We Fight. And at the beginning, it talks about Eisenhower's grandson talks about that, you know, like how his grandfather would say, you know, every time you build a bomber or battleship or whatever weapon system, that's X number of hospitals, X number of schools, you know, X number of roads that you could have spent the money on. You know, and that's the thing. It's like, you know, in the United States, spend an incredible amount of money on defense, quote unquote. But most of it, like a large chunk of it, is a complete ripoff. It's like, you know, it makes me laugh that the Tea Party is always on about how their government's stealing people blind and spending money, but they don't oppose the military, but they want a stronger military, so they want to spend more money in the military budget. You could cut the military budget in the United States and by 50%, and you wouldn't be one iota in more danger. You know, it's a complete boondoggle and a ripoff of the taxpayers, but you'll never hear anybody say that on television or in print. You know, you never see that discussion about what's with this military budget. It's completely insane.
And it really, in my view, it just puts us at more and more at risk.
Well, exactly.
Like,
well, there's
now
that
you see
that
United
argument.
States,
exactly.
You know, they're
more.
They're setting up a new bases in Australia and kind of, you know, surrounding Iran. And it's just all these kind of plays all around the world. It's just terrible. You know, I've just finished a book. Have you ever read Naomi Klein's The Shock Doctrine?
Yeah, I've read about half of it,
Wow, that's a pretty shocking book.
Yeah, it's quite brilliant. I mean, it's very disturbing, too. And
it really is. It's so sad. I read it. And
such a waste of human.
Yeah, because all of the kind of interference, you know, of the kind of corporate elite and the CIA and the military and all the countries of South America and Central America and the history of Iran, like all around the world, kind of all these public deceptions about different wars and revolutions and how they've kind of funded these things covertly. It's like the elites can't let anyone on earth just live in peace and try to provide for their people. It's so tragic.
As long as there's a buck to be made, there will be people there ripping people off, you know?
It's true. It's funny. It's also simple in a way. It keeps brings me back to Dylan Song, Masters of War.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because it's like that. It's like those masters of war, these people who make so much money through the military-industrial complex, and it's like they don't care what tragedies and suffering their weaponry and such, you know, the human toll it takes around the world. It's an amazing book that I got bogged down about halfway through, but I finished it up this week because it's an amazing book because it's very clever. Like, she begins with some of the research is on Cameron, the psychiatrist at McGill University in Montreal, who is doing experimentation for the CIA and giving huge doses of electroshock to people, trying to kind of erase their minds almost. He wanted to kind of create a blank slate so then you could kind of
break them down to shock and awe, basically, you know.
Exactly.
Which he says is what is paralleled by the strategy of which is derived from Milton Friedman and the Chicago School of Economics and applied globally to all lands in which the United States wants to pursue its interests. Yeah.
Exactly.
It's a great parallel that she really develops. I find it very convincing because I think they do speak the same language, and I think the same basic strategy applies, you know.
Yeah, it's very clever what she's saying. And later in the book, some very other interesting parts, like she talks about reconstruction after the tsunami. And she uses a tsunami, like in parts of Sri Lanka and Thailand, and how when the tsunami occurred and it kind of devastated all these small coastal villages on the islands and that, and how the elites kind of used that. They kind of came in and they herd up all the fishermen and farmers and put them inland in kind of, not FEMA camps, but something equivalent along that line inwardly so that they can seize all their coastal lands because they got big investors who want to move in and put in, you know, big hotels and resorts. So they use opportunities like that, like natural calamities to, you know, steal the lands of people. And that was another kind of example of the shock doctrine where you have some natural disaster. I mean, it's a little bit like what's happening in the Gulf of Mexico. You've had that terrible Gulf oil spill and all the Corexit that's been sprayed, and now the people are, you know, more and more people in the area are sick, and, you know, it may force evacuation more and more of that Gulf region.
Yeah.
You know, again, it's like there's always someone who's kind of going to come in and benefit from it. She calls it like disaster capitalism.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And she also had amazing sections. This is really new to me. I just finished the book within the last week, and it really shocked me. She talks about in the States how much of the government has been kind of franchised out to different private corporations. Whereas the military, you know, if they were going to be stationed in an area, they would have their own kind of supply and everything, and they would kind of undertake the job themselves, whereas now it's these multi-billion dollar contracts to Halliburton and KBR and these huge, massive companies, which these guys all have stocks and investments
in. Oh, yeah.
In.
You didn't know about that?
And they've kind of outsourced more and more of government functions. No, I didn't understand that.
Oh, yeah, private contractors. There's something like, A couple of years ago, I heard a report about a Marine sergeant in Iraq who got out of the shower and went to his room and flicked the light switch and was electrocuted. It was his third tour in Iraq, and it turned out he was something like the 23rd U.S. service person, this is a couple of years ago, who had been electrocuted in Iraq, because the contractors, the private contractors who do the wiring there, are so corrupt and so shoddy in their work that people die all the time by being electrocuted.
Wow.
And, you know, it's the amount of money that has been made in Iraq and Afghanistan by private contractors is astounding. As I say, like, you know, this is the so-called defense budget. It's not. It's a boondoggle. It's a gift to these corporate entities. And like the Carlyle Group, which Frank Carlucci created, is all these ex-defense people. They all go and they join it, and they make millions of dollars as directors of this group that provides all these services to the defense establishment. And the whole thing is rigged, you know, like from top to bottom, the whole system. But, you know, one of the things, it's like the number of mercenaries there, like Blackwater and these mercenary groups that service security personnel, quote unquote, is getting larger and larger. And that's basically what happened in the Roman Empire, is that eventually part of the fall of the Roman Empire is because they had to hire mercenaries rather than fight their own wars. Like the Roman army got so overextended that they basically brought all these mercenaries in. That was one of the causes of the fall. But, you know, it's a very, very, like I say, you'll never see anything on an American news program. You'll never see anything in a newspaper about this. I mean, where there's real discussion of this, or very rarely, like, you know, it's just so incredibly corrupt. And when people start yelling about how the government wastes their money, it's like, well, start and end with the defense, you know, the defense establishment. Why does anybody ever criticize that? Because they're all invested in it. You know, years ago, I remember reading this book about by Hedrick Smith, who was a Washington political writer, called The Power Game, and he was describing how they do things in terms of ensuring that projects get carried through. So if you want to build a tank, for instance, what you do is when you pitch it, whoever's building it, you parcel it out so that every congressional district gets a piece of the creation of the tank. So
that's the earmarks, isn't it? Is that what's called?
Every congressional district.
Earmarks?
Yeah, is going to be invested in it. Yeah, so so you know, nobody's going to vote against it. And he cites the example in this one case where the military, actually the army, didn't want this tank because it didn't friggin' work, but they couldn't stop it because they'd already committed the money to it, and nobody would say, "Hey,
there's only one
small problem with this tank. It's a friggin' total waste of money." I forget the tank, not the Abrams, but it was in the late 70s, early 80s, and that's the way things are done. You know, it's like the money is spread around. Everybody wets their beak, and nobody will stop any of this. You know, it's very depressing, actually. So when people say, "Oh, we can't afford to," this is always kills me too. Is that this is the part that I really don't get? Is the same people who describe themselves as being fiscal conservatives or being small-c conservatives will say, you can't fix a problem like poverty by throwing money at it, but that's exactly what they do when it comes to the defense budget. We'll be safer if we throw a lot of money at it. No, you won't. There's no logic to that. It's completely ridiculous. If half of it's going to graft and corruption, how are you any safer?
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, it's really tragic
now as we talk about
this. it's funny, sometimes I just feel overwhelmed by it all. It's just like the extent of the corruption and cruelty and brutality and suffering of humankind through the decades, and everything's based on lies. Like, I see more now. You know, I used to believe that there were more legitimate reasons for wars and there had been more legitimate base for it, but now it's like more and more I see it. It's never what we're told. It's always based on deception, and no one's ever brought to task for all these war crimes.
No, and as you, but as I think you've said repeatedly on this program, it's all explicable in terms of people are dominated by the three lower chakras, this money, sex, and power. Like, you know, it's not that complicated, you know, in terms of the motives of it is all. And that's what people are dominated by, and that's what, and these people are pathologically dominated by money, sex, and power, right? So,
and so they
really have no conscience. And I mean, that's kind of the chilling part that comes through in Naomi Klein's book, eh, is that the ability of people to rationalize or compartmentalize or otherwise abrogate their consciousness, their conscience, and act in these incredibly horrible ways and not seem to be disturbed by it. That's almost actually more disturbing than what they're doing, is the fact that this doesn't seem to bother them at all.
It's amazing,
is chilling. I mean, it's a very chilling book. I mean,
these people are socialized into that type of mentality. In ways I really believe they're victims too, in the sense that they're born into kind of elite families, and these influences, what they see about them and what they face through their life, they buy into that whole mentality. And so it's very complicated. It's not just that they're all bad guys kind of things. It's they're traumatized too, I believe, through their lives. Because I think these
suffering
people...
suffering on a different level. Yeah.
Sorry, Jim?
I think they're suffering on a different level, you know. I think that there is a degree of suffering associated with what they do. And they'll really suffer if there's any kind of reckoning afterwards. It's like, I don't think they're going to very good places when they die.
I don't either. I really don't either.
I, to be perfectly honest, I hope they're not going. You know, like, I mean, I part of me wants some vengeance, you know. Like, I mean, it's just awful, like, where we are.
Yeah, it's nice to believe in divine justice.
It
like,
is,
what's
yeah.
that saying?
Yeah.
Like, vengeance is mine.
I don't have a lot of hope, but I do believe in it, you know?
I do believe in it, even though, like, I can't prove it or I don't absolutely know it. But to me, I mean, just the steps towards it, I'm fully convinced that consciousness isn't simply produced by the body and the brain in the body. And there's very significant scientific research which suggests that consciousness can be experienced apart from the body and also into other dimensions, which is something also that comes out of the near-death experience, that these people actually experience being in other dimensions with other living conscious beings and other environments. So all of this kind of points to a multidimensional universe, and we don't know how these things could work, but scientists haven't even really put their thinking caps on to explore these possibilities. I don't think they have. I don't see them. No,
they haven't.
No.
It was odd, you know, after our last program, we were talking about Dr. Pim Van Lommel's book, Consciousness Beyond Life, The Science of the Near-Death Experience, and he's a Dutch cardiologist who has written this very interesting book, did a long-term study on the near-death experience, and has really produced a wonderful book in terms of his discussion, sort of summary of this last 40 years of research that's been done on this topic, or 35 years of research, I guess, that's been done on this topic. And I went back and I read, I went through my notes and started sort of taking notes from another book that I'd read, which I mentioned, by David Lormer, called Hole in One, which was written in the early 80s.
Oh, yeah.
And I think he's the president of the British Society for the Study of Near-Death Experiences, something to that effect. And I remember at the time being really impressed by his book, and I think I said on this program that I thought Van Lommel's book was the best book that I'd read in terms of really bringing things together and exploring the implications. But I think I sort of slighted David Lormer's book, because David Lormer's book is really interesting in the sense that he relates the material to all sorts of mystical and esoteric teachings, and there's a very good discussion in his book about a variety of topics. I really recommend that book if you can find it. It's called
I had it for years, but I lost it in my fire.
Yeah, that's what I thought. If I can find it for you, I'll buy it for you, and because I really think you'd be very, very interested in what he says. One of the things that came out in his book that really struck me, more than anything else, that I didn't really know about the near-death experience, was he talks a lot about, I think he had the phrase he has is empathic resonance, that's a topic he explores through a variety of like mystical experiences and near-death experiences, and he talks about that subset of the people who have near-death experiences who, when they have the life review, they don't only see, you know, when the typical experience of the life review is where people at an incredibly high speed see their entire life usually going backwards, and they are very cognizant and very aware of everything as if it's happening in real time, but it's very sped up, so there's like this incredible speed of processing of the information. What he talks about is that there are a number of people who report that when they have this experience, they not only are aware of their experience in great detail, but they're aware of the effect of their experience on everyone else with whom they've interacted. Now, to me, like, this is like, you know, you could burn down a library on every psychology department in the Western world and just study this, and I think you'd be much farther ahead in terms of real psychology, because that, it, to me, is like such an amazing, like, set of data that how do you explain that? Like, I mean, to me, it's very clear that it points to a holographic reality. I'm not sure that I really understand. You know, people can say, well, it's interacting holographs, whatever the hell that means. But, I mean, I think that's such an incredibly important, and as you say, it's an important experience and experiential set of data. But it also points to the fact that people are in some sort of higher faculties or higher dimensions of their own minds, and there are in these physical higher dimensions somehow where these things happen, and they're in contact with these beings of light, and they're, you know, all the other aspects of the near-death experience. But what is that? Like, I think that's like such an important question, is like, how is that possible? But it has such like implications in terms of the ideas of karma and spiritual teachings that talk about this, that, you know, that everything we do, we are all ultimately connected, and, you know, that everything that I do is basically reflected in everything everybody else does, and, you know, as we're all tied together somehow on some level, and I as I say, I can't get over that. I just think that's so important.
Yeah, it is, and it's the person is aware of things that they weren't even aware of at the time.
Yeah,
because
well,
they
exactly.
weren't aware at the time of these things, because they were caught up in
their own
focus of themselves, their own identifications, exactly.
Yeah, and their own perspective. And it's as I was thinking in Gurdjieff terms, and I think, like, in a way, I think you can make the argument that when people are, where are people in terms of their consciousness, like, they're in some sort of extra-dimensional space, it seems, when they have these near-death experiences. They're in some higher dimension.
Mm-hmm.
But it also seems like they're in their higher emotional center. Or they're somehow in their astral body or something. They're not in their normal mode of knowing. That's why I think in a way they are in their higher emotional center, because they have capacities that they don't have when they're in their normal state of consciousness. And it would seem like that would be at an attribute of your higher emotional center, is that you would have this empathic resonance with everyone, and you would understand the effects of not only what you're doing, but how it's affecting everybody else. I'm just sort of speculating now, but I'm trying to understand, how would you make sense of this experience? I just, you know, not really sure.
Well, I mean, I think those are good points you're making. I mean, it shows the non-local nature of reality, that in a way there are these vast information, the amount of information latent within space itself.
Exactly.
And that we can access this kind of, these information fields and kind of apprehend, you know, vast amount of information simultaneously. Like, we can know things in this expanded way. And it shows also, like, the empathic resonance that it suggests that even normally we are could be being influenced by each other's emotional states and such, but it's just below our awareness. But
these fields are existent
in our relationships and lives and such.
And that's what Lorimer argues and provides evidence from a variety of studies and things and anecdotal evidence that, as you say, normally we're just not aware of it. So we don't make that connection, but this is going on all the time. And he has several examples of this that are very suggestive of that. And I say, the idea of the existence of the Akashic record, where nothing really happens is lost. Everything is somehow stored in some sort of higher dimensional memory space, which is accessible if we can develop or can tap into the higher aspects of our mind through the higher emotional or higher intellectual centers, in Gurdjieff's terms, or like the higher being bodies. Then we can gain access to this information, and it's all there and can be read out. And again, it's like the idea like that you've explained about the within without phenomena of the arising and dissipation of consciousness with the death of the physical body, is that consciousness emerges out of this higher dimensional space and is stepped down and manifests and illuminates the psychic functions in the human being and that provides the life principle. And then at death, it withdraws into the heart space and then reverts into these higher dimensional spaces. Well, that's entirely consistent kind of with what's being described, is some sort of life and consciousness principle exists independently of the functioning of the physical organism. Like the body is essentially dead because there's no brain activity, there's no cardiac activity, and yet the person is still fully conscious. And not only are they fully conscious, but after they go through this tunnel, which again is like the idea of a portal from one dimension to another, they emerge and they're not only aware of themselves, but they develop all these capacities of mindfulness that don't exist in normal waking consciousness. And it's entirely consistent with this idea that we arise, that life comes from life, as the Hare Krishna say, and that in this higher dimensional space, we have higher dimensional faculties of consciousness and being.
Yeah. Wow. So maybe it'll be nice to get out of this place. I don't like living in a lunatic asylum. You know, I'm kind of like a pretty normal, kind of ordinary person, despite my kind of esoteric interests. I just find, like, wow, you know, we're in this mad situation. I could never have believed it all.
Remember that animal song, "We Gotta Get Out of This Place"? It was the last thing we ever do.
Yeah.
It may be the last thing you ever do. You know?
It's interesting also, though, how in quantum theory itself, when particles separate from a singlet state, they remain interrelated in higher dimensional phase space.
Yeah.
And what's so interesting is that, like, our universe began from a singularity point.
Yeah, exactly.
So what this kind of suggests,
it's all entangled at some point.
Yeah,
right?
It was always entangled from the very beginning. Like,
that's why I don't understand why people don't see that. It's like it's sort of logical, isn't it?
It's inherent to quantum theory in a way, this kind of cosmic memory, because it's suggested by the quantum paradoxes of non-locality and kind of the interconnectedness of elements which have entered into unity states. So since things differentiate out of unity states, that memory is kind of inherent. And it's not that the memory is encoded in things like memory engrams.
Yeah.
Like, instead, the memory is actually encoded in matter.
Yeah.
In the quantum states of, like, the spin particles or the movement of matter itself. Like, it's not that memory is a separate thing. Memory is not separate from matter. It's inherent to matter. Something, I'm not sure exactly what I'm trying to say, but It's like how they could never find memory engrams in the head. Like, Hebb used to think there were particular cell assemblies that would record unique memories, but they could never find them.
Yeah,
and the more and more they searched for memory, and they removed parts of animals' brains and so on, but the memory always seemed to persist. So somehow it's more that memory is inherent to the nature of matter and these higher dimensional.
It's extrapolated into higher dimensional. Like it's stepped down. It's informing through these higher dimensions and manifesting through matter, but it's not actually in matter itself. It's like Lashley said. You know, he kept cutting parts of animals' brains out, and he tried for like 30 years to find the engram, which was supposed to be the substance and site of matter. It was like the name that they had given to it. And he said after 40 years of research, he'd proved that learning wasn't possible, you know. But it is. And that's how, and then Prebram was Lashley's student, and that's why Prebram came to the idea of the holographic storage of memory, like that memory is not, that memory is distributed throughout the entire brain and is read out through this complex mathematics of Fourier transforms, which is the mathematics that underlies holography, and somehow it's, I mean, I don't think Prebram takes a full step in a sense, but it's like, you know, it all points to like the non-local nature of mind and memory. Like, as you say, like if the cosmos is mindful, and I think it is, and it's intelligent, then there has to be some memory. And so I think those are like, that's an aspect of the universal mind, and the multiple, the multi-dimensional nature of mind is that it exists on different levels, and that they step down and inform lower levels, and then there's like a feeding back through evolution from the lower to the higher. But there's this involutionary process that's going on all the time, which underlies and informs the manifestation of matter, because like in all living things, the matter is continually in flux, and there's no actual physically stable organism. It's a dynamic pattern, which the pattern itself is stable. The pattern has memory too, and some sort of programming, because everything lives dies eventually. So that, you know, there are sort of built-in programs of change on some level, but there's also built-in memory, because if you have an injury, you know, like you scar, and even though that the physical cells don't exist, which were in existence when the original injury happens, like you still have a scar, or you still have like loss of function from the injury. So it's a very complex question, but there has to be some sort of mindfulness informing all that and remembering everything that's happened. But that's the way I see it anyways. I don't understand in biology why there's not more recognition of this paradox about the flux of the physical organism, and the fact that, and it's not even in the DNA. Like, I mean, that, you can't just say that, because I mean, DNA is changing itself too. So,
I mean, that's why Sheldrake's work was fascinating. Rupert Sheldrake, an English experimenter and biologist, and who's shown, well, he develops the idea of what he calls the morphogenic fields, which are like information fields or mind fields almost, that are shared by, for instance, a species of animals. And he gives examples where, for instance, you teach a number of rats in the U.S. how to run a maze in a certain way. And as those rats learn that task, what seemingly seems to happen is that it'll be easier for those rats in Australia to learn those tasks.
Yeah.
This was an example he used, and I think had experimental evidence for it to some extent. Obviously,
Wasn't there an example too of the birds that were opening the milk, the old-fashioned milk bottles, and they were taking the tops off the milk bottles and getting at the milk, and this phenomenon sort of spread to other places. There was, because there was a change in the milk bottle. Isn't there something like that about birds in different places?
Yeah, that was another example, I think.
He has a lot of kind of compelling examples of how this is like sort of defies a, like a billiard ball explanation of transfer of information, and so something somehow non-locally is happening, which would sort of defy the overcome the seeming limitations imposed by time and space, like things happening in very distant places somehow being affected by these other places. And again, it comes back to what we were talking about, empathic resonance, and I mean, even in like what Sheldrick's work, like one of the great enigmas in biology is morphology. It's like how, when cells are dividing, how do they know to become, you know, the cells that form an eye and the cells that form a kidney, and, you know, like that, it's, nobody really understands that. That's still like a huge problem in biology.
Yeah.
It points to some sort of mindfulness again, like, you know, that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm losing. I had an association, but, okay, so well, we're talking about.
I'm sorry, because I sort of cut you off a bit. You were talking about
the Sheldrake and
morphogenic fields and Sheldrake and morphic resonance and how things were explicable, like different examples he had of like mice learning and some sort of maze, and then this being passed to other mice in other areas of the world. And,
It's interesting. It seems at times, like, I think a lot of people think that as science advances, like, we've learned more and more, and there's kind of less and less to know. But in a way, it's really quite the opposite. In a way, as science has advanced, there's more and more inexplicable phenomena which just continually confound people. And like we reach one pinnacle where we understand some element on some domain, but then all of a sudden it reveals these even greater mysteries beyond us. It's astonishing the depth of the kind of mystery of life and what we really are as beings. It's an astonishingly deep mystery, and that we're all in that mystery play. It's a shame people don't, I don't think generally people have much a sense of the mystery of their own existence and the mystery of their own consciousness, like just how unusual a phenomena that is and how science has like absolutely no way of comprehending it. And we live in this mystery, but I don't think many people really realize the extent of the mystery of it.
I wholeheartedly agree, and I'm kind of struck by that, like very much, like how, as you say, I think in a way it's like because science provides some answers to some things, and people have some awareness of what science has and hasn't established about things, they tend to kind of repeat pat explanations, like you know if you. And well, in terms of the question of evolution, like you see people when they talk about evolution generally, I think people have very kind of reflexive understandings and they don't see that, you know, there is some choice other than being a like a strict creationist, a fundamentalist creationist, or, you know, a militant
evolutionist, Darwinian.
Like Darwinian evolutionist, like Richard Dawkins, you know, it's like that there are, you know, that there is evolution, like the, broadly speaking, and that clearly does exist. But at the same time, like the phenomenon in itself is so incredibly complicated, and we don't understand life or consciousness. So I don't understand how we could possibly know what evolution is. And as you say, in a way, like the farther, the deeper we get into trying to answer these questions, the more mysteries that are really posed by anybody who really thinks about it. But I think people sort of are very happy just to kind of have these pat explanations and, oh, I'm an evolutionist, I don't, you know, and just sort of dismiss like all spiritual perspectives on it, or think that, oh, it's all sort of worked out. You know, they know that we came from apes and, you know, that's...
Or they have the other attitude, which is, oh, I believe in God and there's God and I have a soul and I go to heaven afterwards. And then it's just like all so simple in that way. And then they don't...
Pie in the sky kind of...
It's just a belief system.
Yeah. And the more complex approach is to try to understand these things as hypotheses, as like somewhat of a scientific perspective, but that's the way I think it is. Well, what is the evidence for these explanations? And I mean, when you really start to look at the explanations of almost everything, there's huge holes in any major issue that confronts us in terms of the meaning of our existence or the nature of our existence. Like, it's all up for grabs. Like, there's fascinating questions and fascinating mysteries that confront us all. And even, like, you know, even if you have a very sophisticated esoteric perspective on it, like, it's the same thing. It's like, you know, there's huge friggin' holes and that still remain. It's like, you know, like, I think, you know.
Oh, yeah, it doesn't answer all the questions.
I think
but
your model
is
an alternative to a lot of things about the nature of consciousness. And you know, it's a very interesting perspective. But, like, as we get deeper into this, right, it's like we could spend another several lifetimes trying to figure this out, and we'd still be a long way from knowing what the hell is going on.
Just look at the history of mankind, how many years we've been investigating human nature, and there's still all these fundamental enigmas. But I think that's the value of all the paranormal and psychological and psychical literature, is it reminds us that there's something so much deeper that we can't grasp.
Yeah.
But I think we both in our lives, for similar and different reasons, became convinced ourselves that there's something to this. And we don't know how to understand it, but we have to remain open to try to comprehend it in a deeper way, that there's some fundamental mystery here that's not been answered. And it's fun living in that mystery.
Yeah.
I like living in the mystery. I don't feel I have to have premature closure and just know, oh, yeah, you know, I go to heaven and see Jesus or Buddha or whoever, you know. It's not like to not have those things set, but to live being in the mystery of it.
I mean, that's why I think the near-death experience is such an incredible... that phenomena has become such an interesting body of research, because it comes out of development in science. A lot of it, I mean, people have had near-death experiences all through the history of humankind, but it's become much more prevalent and much more thoroughly documented when it's occurred, and because of the advances in cardiac resuscitation in the last 40 years. And it has really opened, I think, the significant element to the medical community have kind of realized, well, you know, maybe this isn't just sort of a case of people having a lack of oxygen. And I think people who started out as skeptics have really investigated and realized that this is something that begs explanation and we can't explain it. And it also points out to sort of the inherent fallacy in our established medical and scientific view about the materialist perspective on life and consciousness, and that it, clearly there's something wrong with that explanation.
Yeah.
Oh, by the way...
I noticed we're coming down, so we'll just take a couple minutes to close up here. Jim's only able to be with me for the first hour of today's show, so what we're going to do in a couple minutes is we're going to take a break and hear... our intermission song called Sacred Land. And then afterwards, I'm going to give a bit of a talk on a new book I've published. My book's actually in print, Jim.
Oh, good.
1137. If you have a look at my website, you'll see the picture. You'll see the picture of it. And I've ordered copies myself, so I haven't seen it yet. And
okay.
I hope it is in there aren't too many grammatical or other printing problems. I've ordered some copies which are supposed to be in by Wednesday. It was quite an ordeal finishing up that book, I must say. It takes me into the political kind of crazy world, and boy, at times it's tiring something about it. I was so pleased to get through that book. I kind of felt in a way I owed it to Karen, because the book is dedicated to her, as my last book was. And this material is material that I produced through the last years of time I had with Karen after we woke up to the kind of crimes of 9/11 and the fraud of that. So it's kind of a political book. Boy, after writing that, I want to get back to my mystical studies. I was thinking next year. I think that's like I've done this political kind of conspiracy theory book about the world situation. But I was looking, well, what am I going to work at next? And it's like I want to get back to the within without from Zero Point series, eh?
Yeah.
Because that microcosm, macrocosm book, I want to finish that up next year and finish the next volume of that series. It's like I want to continue to pursue my esoteric science studies.
I think there's a lot there that you could further refine, and you know, there's lots of ideas to explore, and there's always new material, you know, and so you could probably go back and rework that a bit and develop new material too. But there's always things. That's the beauty of this. I'm just trying to finish up the problem of God's contracting universe, but I'm having a little bit of trouble. I want to keep it to like three chapters left, one to deal a little bit further with your work and explain the model a little in more detail. It's selected aspects of the heart doctrine of the zero point teaching, but also I want to have a chapter on the near death experience. And I realize, I'm trying to step back. That's why I was rereading my notes from Lorimer and going through that book and looking at Dr. Van Lommel's book and thinking, well, how can I really extrapolate here? Because you can write a whole book easily about just this experience. But how I want to tie that sort of together with how it fits in terms of your presentation and the ideas that I raised in the book about the enigmas and mysteries of consciousness. And I think it's like, I think it's just such an important body of research. I just find it really fascinating and it leads to all sorts of connections, but it's like, it's hard to kind of reduce these things to, 30 pages or so. It's very, very difficult. So that's what I'm doing. I'm just sort of focused on that. I want to get volume one of this book done and out there, because I just really kind of sick of writing it, to be perfectly honest. I just want to get it tidied up and done, you know, because with all due modesty, I think it's a really good book. And I think it's well written and presented, but it's like, it's your work, and it's, your work is very interesting, and it's other people's work. And it's just like, you know, been living with this for so long that I feel like I know this topic to well enough to be able to write about it. So, and as I say, it's only the first volume of probably three volumes. So I just want to get it done.
Yeah, it's a relief. That's what I found when I finished up this book the last couple weeks. It was such a relief, and it was exhausting in a way, finishing it up.
Yeah. It takes a lot out of you, but
So in the second half of the show today, I'm going to come back and talk about my new book and talk a little bit about its content and share some of the substance of one of the chapters and talk about the numerological meaning of the number 1137. And I want to go into that a little bit. It's an interesting feature in this book is the derivation of that number. So, okay, Jim, are you going to be available? Our next show is on Christmas Eve.
Yeah, I know. That might be a problem for me. It just sort of depends. I'm going to have to let you know, you know.
Okay, and I'm going to have to see, too. So we may have to have a...
I'm going to Ottawa, it'll depend in part, I think, on the weather, but also in terms of my brother's health, so...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Well, thanks, I'll talk to you hopefully in 2 weeks. But I'll see you personally. But I mean, I hope I talk to you on the radio in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks, Jim.
All right. See ya.
Okay. So what we're going to do now, I'm going to ask Don in the studio to play our intermission song, and I'm going to take 5 minutes, and then we'll come back and we'll pick up with some more discussions. Okay.
I remember all the stories my grandpa used to tell about a time in this sacred land. The buffalo did roam out on the open plain, the eagle soared high in the sky. There wasn't any there wasn't any pain. Yes, he said, they were so very proud. They lived a simple life. Mother Nature did provide. There was no law, but there was no crime. He brought his whale up. Nothing's been the same the day the white man came. Yes, they brought their whiskey and they brought their gun. They took away our land. They put us on the run. Locked us on this reservation. Changed our ways of life. Promises were made, but they were only lies. The nations, they will rise. All the chiefs from long ago, they will be by your side. Into the battleground, a warrior you will ride. Armed with years of wisdom, many years of pride. The day the white man came, he brought his whale out. Nothing's been the same the day the white man came.
That is called Sacred Land by a native Canadian, Robin, from out in BC. And I hope someday, Robin, I'll come out and get to meet you. Okay, so I'm just by myself on the second half. And I want to give out the BBS phone and number, toll-free number, and invite people, if anyone would like to call in. And we don't often open the lines up. And then when I do, I don't often get a call. Because I don't open it up very often. But anyway, the number is 888-627-6008. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk a little bit about this book, which I've just published this last week, and give an idea of what the book is about and talk a little bit of its content and substance. People familiar with my show and my work with Jim probably realize Jim and I have very different perspectives on certain issues. Jim, in a way, he recognizes the kind of monstrosity of things that have been done within our society, and including 9/11, but he doesn't see there as being an organized global conspiracy. He doesn't think that there's that inner organization to it and such. Whereas in my studies lead me to view the world situation in terms of there actually being an Illuminati type group, and they're centered in London, England, the city of London, and it's tied into the big banking families and world Zionism and the Rothschilds and J.P. Morgan, Rockefellers. And so I believe there has been this very intentional, systematic criminal conspiracy, which has gone on well in it, through the time of our lives, and likely has gone back centuries, and some people trace it back millennium even. I'm not studied enough in ancient history. But I believe in modern times, it's undeniable, in my view, that there is this push for a new world order, which I call the old world psychiatric disorder. And firstly, because I don't think what these people would bring in is anything new. Like, if we look at the history of humanity, it's a history of warfare and suffering and subjugation of people and impoverishment of people and intentional spreading of sickness in the population. And we have a long history of this. We've never been free of it. I don't think there's never been a time in modern history where we haven't been under the control of these psychopathic elites. And that's never been as evident as it is today in our societies. When we look at the fact that 9/11 was a complete fraud. Okay, 9/11 had nothing to do with Muslims. It had nothing to do with the hijacking of airplanes. And if people familiar with my work, you'd realize I argue that there weren't any airplanes at all anyway, that the airplanes was a media hoax. You see, it was simply the images of the airplane were concocted in the media studios as the day's events unraveled, and then they subsequently produced different editions of films or videos of these airplanes. And if you go to my website, I have an article there, about a 40-page article, called Fabled Airplanes, on the role of the corporate media in creating and perpetuating the mass hypnosis of the American public. See, people think that our media reports the news objectively, but really this is not at all what the corporate media does. The role of the corporate media is intentionally to deceive the American public. And they deceive the public about every significant thing going on nationally and internationally on a daily basis. Okay, we have a completely corrupted criminal media. Okay, the media, they help in the staging of false flag events. They have scripted witnesses. Okay, I believe 9/11 was scripted ahead of time, and I do a forensic analysis of some of the witnesses who claim to have seen the airplanes or claim to have seen the airplanes disappear into the buildings. And in my view, there's no doubt but that these were scripted witnesses and that they tell lies in their evidences. Okay, it's fabricated evidences. See, the media plays people, the masses of people, that you believe what you see on TV. Like, if you ever, everybody thinks that 9/11 involved hijacked airplanes, and you say, well, why do you believe that? Well, they saw it on TV. That's why, because you saw it on TV. You saw it on TV. It's like the next thing to what really happened. But unfortunately, just like you could watch a movie or any other drama on TV, and the events aren't really happening, well, the same with 9/11. It was a completely concocted day's events. Had nothing to do, I'm saying, there were no Muslims hijacking airplanes. There were no videos of any of the Muslims at any of the airports. Okay, there were no hijacked airplanes. Some airplanes may have deviated in their course, and there's lots of enigmas about what happened on that day. But I say there is no evidence that there were planes that hit the towers, and that an airplane wouldn't possibly simply slice into the towers of the type of construction of the North Towers and just slip inside into a hole and completely disappear from view. it's completely ridiculous to imagine this as occurring in that way. These airplanes would break up on impact, and some of the airplanes would go into the building, but much of it would break up on impact. And then the airplanes, of course, couldn't possibly bring down the buildings, but that's a separate issue. And I'm saying there wasn't even airplanes. And I'm saying also that many of these major events that occur, like the shooting, the mass shooting that occurred in the States, I forget the, if it was Oklahoma or where it was, involving a senator and a judge, I believe that that was another of their staged events. And that when these they perpetrate these staged events, they always have scripted witnesses and actors and actresses. And this last week I saw some very interesting video of this man. I unfortunately don't have the web links or name, but what he's showing that there's certain groups of actors and actresses that you see interviewed at different major news events. And he pulls out some of these. He uses, for instance, this Marine in New York City who supposedly addressed the police who were intimidating the people and kind of spoke out on behalf of the people. And he argues that this man is indeed an actor and this whole thing has been scripted. Okay, so the media simply cannot be trusted. And I remember when I woke up to the 9/11 fraud about 5 years ago, and there was a shooting in Canada, Dawson College in Montreal. And I could see in an awakened state, just from watching the news, I could see that it was being staged and the witnesses were fraudulent. I mean, I'm a clinical and forensic psychologist, so I'm used to dealing with pathological liars. So I could just see that some of their witnesses were scripted and faked. And people don't realize how often this is done. In a way, our mainstream corporate media, its intention isn't to inform people. Its intention is to deceive people. Okay, this is part of the psyops against the American public. Is this mass hypnosis of the public perpetrated through the media. See, the media can persuade the American public why you should give $37 or $40 trillion to the bankers who committed bank fraud and all kinds of irregularities in bookkeeping and such. Okay, and the media can persuade the public why all this money should be going to these people instead of putting them in jail and charging them with all kinds of fraud and criminal racketeering and such, why instead the American people should impoverish your country and seven generations of your children to give billions and billions, trillions of dollars to these financial criminals. And the media can present it all why you should do this, and they can bring out all their little experts from all the different Rockefeller think tanks, all these like experts on terrorism. And they'll trot their little experts on terrorism out. And they have all these scripted experts, which really aren't experts at all. What they are professional liars with academic credentials. And they come out and they brainwash the American public, or Canadian public, or world public. This isn't a uniquely American phenomena. It's done in Canada. CTV in Canada helped commit a mass murder in Montreal, murdered two people so the government could get new gun laws to prohibit semi-automatic weapons. The whole thing is staged. The whole thing is staged. That's what they do. You can go around the world. There's all these fake shootings, multiple shootings, and it's almost always at some kind of staged event. The truth never comes out. There's always all kinds of enigmas, how many shooters there really were and how it possibly could have happened, and always unsolved questions. And then the government itself appoints the people who will investigate it and give you a final report. like they did for 9/11, like they did for the assassination of Kennedy, and so on. So the inquiries never really get to the heart of the matter. So anyway, coming back to my new book, is called 1137. So it begins with this number, 1137. And in the book, I put a number of chapters of my book up on my website. If you go to the last chapter in the book, it explains the significance of the numbers 1137. But in the book, that time is on the clock, which is on the cover of the book. And the cover of the book is a shot that I took, a photograph of the Canadian Houses of Parliament, the Peace Tower. And on the Canadian Houses of Parliament, the Peace Tower has the Star of David on the clock, on the Peace Tower. And a couple of weeks ago, I was up on Parliament Hill. I went up to take part in the 9/11 Truth Group. We're on Parliament Hill trying to educate the public about 9/11. And I spent the day there. Actually, I held my radio show from Parliament Hill on that date, September 17th. And during the day, I took photographs of the Ottawa skyline because it was a very clear, sunny day, beautiful day. But all day long, they were chemtrail spraying the citizens of Ottawa. So I was taking pictures of the chemtrails through the day. And at one point, I happened to do a close-up of the Peace Tower, capturing, I wanted to get the picture of the Rothschilds or the Star of David on the Peace Tower. And the time on the clock happened to be 11:37. Even though I didn't realize that at the time, as I took the shot, only subsequently did I realize the time on the clock and the significance of that, or at least why it was especially significant to me. And I'll come back to that shortly. So the book is called 1137, God's Contracting Universe. Now, in my work, at a later, earlier point in my life, I started writing about the problem of God's contracting universe 30 years ago. And what I meant by that, it was based on an analysis of Carl Sagan's writing. And Carl Sagan once had the comment to the effect that as science learns more and more, there's less and less for God to do. And that the idea was, oh yeah, so God's universe is contracting. The more we learn in science, the less reason we have to believe in the existence of God. So for many years, I used that phrase, the problem of God's contracting universe, to talk about the debate between science and religion. And asking the question, is this really true? What is it that science has established that makes us doubt the existence of God? And how does it bear upon this question? Well, in this book, the idea of God's contracting universe, it has a very different meaning because in a way, what it's talking about is the rise of Zionism and Satanism in the world, and how thoroughly our society has been degraded, and intentionally, in my view. We've been socially engineered for decades in the Western world. These elite classes have taken over the media. They've taken over the educational system. They've rewritten and sanitized their version of history. They've kept all kinds of esoteric knowledge from people. They've hidden all kinds of inventions which could solve many of the problems of humanity on this planet. So in a way, in my view, we're sinking into this fascist New World Order system. And in my view, there is a group of psychopaths who do want to reduce world's population. And we see in the Georgia Guidestones, the aim, as stated on the first principle on the Georgia Guidestones for their new age of reason, is that the first principle, they want to maintain population under 500 million which they say would be a sustainable environment or a sustainable planet. So I do believe there is a group of psychotic or psychopathic maniacs who have this vision of reducing world's population so that the elites can put all the worker population into the cities and they can let the country and go back to the wild, so they can run around with no clothes on and pee on trees and enjoy each other's fine company like they like to do out at Bohemian Grove. And the elites will be able to travel in the country and they'll have worker populations in cities. These people have quite some fantastic kind of psychotic vision of this psychiatrically disordered society that they're creating. And they've done everything they can to degrade human beings, okay, through the spreading of pornography and the encouragement of sexual perversity and promiscuity. Okay, the women's liberation movement was an attempt to free women and break down the family structure, because the elites don't really want family structures. They want to destroy the family. They want to destroy Christianity, because the Zionists, particularly Talmudic Jews, hate Christianity and see, the Abe Foxman describes the New Testament as a hate-filled document, ultimately responsible, he says, for the murder of 6 million Jews. Okay, so Foxman actually says this. Okay, see, partly this is some people call it the Jew world order, and it's very, I'm sorry for Jewish people, because I think most of the Jewish community has been as deceived by this whole agenda as have the masses of humankind. At one point in my life, I was a professor in a predominantly Jewish university, and all my friends and loves at different times were Jewish. So I've never in my life had problems with Jewish people on a one-to-one basis. And it's awful that so many people call this like the Jew world order. And it is so tied into Zionist Judaism. But this isn't the Jewish community, but rather this is religious fanatics within the Jewish community. And there's opposition to the New World psychiatric disorder within the Jewish community as well. I know this last week I saw an assembly of Jews in New York City burning the flag of Israel. So there are groups of Jews who deny the authenticity of the state of Israel. And before Israel was formed, the Muslims, the Christians, and the Jews got along fine before the state of Israel was born. It was only afterwards that the terrorists began to act out against the Palestinians and to want to create greater Israel. Well, now Israel has they lead the United States around by the hook of the nose, and all your senators and politicians all swear their allegiance to Israel. So in a way, the United States has been hijacked by this Zionist mafia, and Canada is the same way. Okay, and England is the same way, and many of the countries of the world. These elites have worked away subversively for years and deceived the public through the media so that the public was never really aware of what was being done. They even say these things themselves, that they have to bring in their new agenda incrementally so that people don't realize what is happening until it's too late. Sometimes people compare it to the cooking of a frog, where if you put a frog in a pot of hot water, it'll react so quickly it'll jump out. But if you put a frog in a pot of medium lukewarm water and gradually heat the water up, then the frog will end up getting cooked because it's because of the incrementalism. And that's kind of what's being done in our society. We've had the incremental destruction of our society. And then at certain points, you have dramatic turns in that, like this last week, this absolutely atrocious bill in the States, which allows the police and military to pick up and execute any American citizen or anyone in the world, anywhere, anytime, no judges, no lawyers, no courts, no evidence. Even if they just don't like you, they can get away with anything. They've given themselves complete license to mass murder anyone they want, anywhere, anytime. And it's a complete violation of the Constitution of the United States. And yet, I think out of 200 senators, there were 7 who opposed it, or however many senators. There were 7 senators who opposed it. As absolutely, it's a treasonous bill. It violates everything that America stands for as a nation. And we see, it shows the fact that there's so many of our elected representatives who support this bill. It just shows the Zionist control of the political machine and parties of the United States. And this isn't just to be critical of Americans, because the American people, you've been deceived in America just like we in Canada have been deceived by our governments. See, that's why, like, sometimes I used to wonder, all the 9/11 people, I'd be out at 9/11 events and people asking, you know, 9/11 was an inside job, 9/11 was an inside job. And I used to wonder, like, why are the people out here trying to get justice in society? Like, where are the police? Like, where are the police? Like, in Canada, we have the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. Okay, why aren't the police capturing the terrorists, the real terrorists? The police know. They know 9/11 was an inside job. And then you begin to realize after a while that this new world psychiatric disorder, it's interpenetrated our whole society. These people have taken over the police, the CIA and the FBI and Canada, the RCMP and CSIS, and all these intelligence and police services. At the highest levels, they are controlled by the same terrorist organizations as who perpetrated 9/11 and the Oklahoma City bombings and the assassination of Kennedy. CIA's never worked for the people of the United States. They're responsible for tens of millions of deaths around the world in different wars and revolutions and uprisings that they've sponsored. Tens of millions of people. Okay, all the time, all based on lies. It's like you can tell the American public anything you want. You just show it on TV and bring out the little experts from a Rockefeller think tank. They come out and they spew their lies, and it's mass hypnosis of the American public. It's complete public deception. It's also what the media is doing is completely criminal. Okay, like the media in the United States, they helped stage 9/11. Okay, on that day, they weren't reporting it. They were scripted ahead of time. They knew what was being done. Okay, this is the rule. You got to turn off, people. Save your brain. Turn your TVs off. Cancel your newspapers. These people have taken all over all the main publishing avenues. And that's why radio stations and the internet is just so profoundly important to the truth movement. So why are the people, see, like all the people in New York going out and trying to occupy Wall Street? And the police come out, and then the police are brutal with these people. And some people think, oh, New York's finest, eh? A New York policeman, yeah. Hey, remember in 2001, they mass murdered 3,000 people in New York City? And, oh, New York's finest, eh? All those policemen. And they believe Osama bin Laden and his reindeer brought down the two towers. All those policemen, New York finest, eh? See, what you begin to realize is that these people, I mean, it's hard to know. Maybe many of the police actually believe the official story. But why don't any of the police stand up for the 300 emergency workers murdered on that day? you'd think the police would be outraged and they'd determine, like, who committed this crime. But instead, they didn't. They fall into silence. They're cowards. They're afraid of losing their job. They allowed 300 of fellow emergency workers to be massacred on that day, and they did nothing. New York's finest, eh? Policemen upholding, fighting terrorism. These guys fight terrorism? They don't fight terrorism. They've gone along with it. Why aren't these people who did 9/11, why aren't they in jail? Because we don't have any meaningful police services anymore. The same criminal cabals who perpetrate these crimes, they own our police force, our police forces. In Canada, I call the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, I call them the Royal Canadian Mounted Perverts. Because, see, they didn't make enough money being police, so they had to pervert the laws. See, the Royal Canadian Mounted Perverts, on that day in 2001, there were 24 Canadians mass murdered on that day. But the RCMP, they don't do anything about it. They went along with it. They allowed the deception of the Canadian public. The RCMP neglected their duty to uphold the laws of Canada. Their criminal acts had led then to the involvement of Canada in the Afghanistan war and led to the murder of 150 or more Canadian soldiers who have died over there. So the RCMP, thank you RCMP, thank you from the Canadian military, thank you for sacrificing Canadian soldiers to maintain your lies and your public deceptions. Thank you RCMP. And the CSIS in Canada, our intelligence community, the same thing. You see, all these organizations at the highest level are controlled by the same criminal cabal that control the Canadian government and the American government and the English government. And in a way, it seems at times so hopeless. Just a complete lawlessness among the nations. Complete lawlessness. And you look at the Christian community. There are no Christians left anymore. In Christianity, one of the things is like, thou shalt not kill. Have anybody ever heard of that? That was like normalcy loving Moses. That was one of his commands, thou shalt not kill. Yeah, people used to actually believe that you shouldn't kill people. Okay, and Christians are supposed to believe, oh, you can't protect and stand up for your brother and protect and stand up for truth and justice. But what did the Christians do in our times? Christians can't say anything, be political. They can't be political because their church might not have their tax grants or they might not have enough prosperity. See, the Christians should be outraged by what's been done. We, Western civilization, we've mass murdered millions of people in the Middle East. Millions of people. Millions of orphan children. Millions of deformed and injured people. Millions of refugees. Millions of pounds of depleted uranium all over the country. These are horrendous crimes against humanity. And what do our police force do? All the police and the FBI, all fighting terrorism. My God, if any of them ever made an effort to fight terrorism, they'd probably shit their pants. You see, they the kind of terrorists, the RCMP, you know, in 10 years of a war on terrorism in Canada, the only ones they ever caught was a group of about 10 individuals that they helped set up as another false flag event. And they supplied them with what was supposed to be explosives, and they picked on some younger Muslim men. And then when they capture this group, all set up and entrapped by the RCMP, then they imprison them all, then they have to have secret trials for them. Okay, secret trials, because if these trials were really public and there was real justice in there, well, the authorities would have a lot to fear. they have to keep the trial secret, because if people really knew what the RCMP and the government was doing, would demand that these people be arrested and persecuted and exposed for their crimes against the Canadian people. 10 years of Canada's war on terrorism, the only one they ever caught was someone they set up. And they let the real terrorists go away. They let them off scot-free. Don't you see what's happening? And in Canada now, you got, you know, when you have the G20 in Toronto, and the what they do there, they did there, they had this black block come in. And there was a news conferences for the media, how the police were concerned about the black bloc, this kind of radical group that was going to be part of the G20. And then you had these black bloc members, and they let them set a police cruiser on fire and smash a bunch of windows. Well, all the police didn't do anything to stop them. And then they had reason. You see, the whole thing was staged by them themselves. They set up the black bloc. No one had ever heard of the black bloc before the G20. Okay? See, they create this, and then they work with the media, because they tell the media, okay, you got to cover the black bloc, and this is what you do. What you got to do is persuade Canadians that we need the police to crack down on protesters. We need it because they're violent. So then the police stage of the violence themselves, and through the media, they completely deceive and brainwash the Canadian public. Okay, so that and then they, even on the mainstream media, they have all their own callers in who call into shows, who sound off, who are all staged. And they'll have Gallup polls or different kinds of polls, and they'll just tell you what people support. They'll create it. See, it's a mass hypnosis, mass public deception. So anyway, crazy, crazy world. Well, my book, 1137, God's Contracting Universe, the subtitle is called The Madness of Humanity, The Ascendancy of the Old World Psychiatric Disorder, and Beyond 2012, The Zero Point Proposal. But this book is about, it tells a story. It tells a story back in 2006 when I kind of woke up to what was happening in the world. And I'd been completely naive until that time. And then my son had showed me the movie Loose Change, and that was a complete shock to me. I had no idea of the issues around 9/11. And then that kind of led to my, over the past 5 years, listening more and more to the internet and the truth networks and trying to understand what's going on in the world. And it's like it just gets worse and worse and worse. It's like, you know, you realize 9/11 is a complete fraud. And then you realize, oh, the London train bombings, another false flag event. Oh, the Madrid train bombings, the Oklahoma City bombing, oh, Kennedy's assassinations, three Kennedys, Robert Kennedy, John Kennedy, and the youngest son, Kennedy, Martin Luther King, John Lennon, and you just realize all these defining events in American history, and the public is just continually misled and deceived about all these events. Meanwhile, we have these psychopathic elites who are just playing the goyim, just the sheep people. Okay, to see among the Zionist elites, they don't value human lives other than their own. Okay, they're quite pleased if they can reduce world's population. To them, there's nothing psychopathic about that. They can even pretend in their own circles that they're saving the planet. You see, when they mass murder people, they don't say, we're going to mass murder people. Well, they say, what we're going to do is save the planet. Yes, yeah, save the planet from extinction, because there's too many people who are breathing and they breathe carbon dioxide, and that's heating the world up, and we're going to explode if we're not hit by a comet or invaded by space beings, and they create all these fears and anxieties among people, and people should be fearful. What's happening in our countries now, it's you know, we're at a precipice. We could sink into a third world war with the attacking of Iran, because they might get a nuclear bomb, okay? They might get, I mean, Israel's got hundreds of nuclear bombs. Israel's never abided by any U.S. resolutions. Israel's been sanctioned by the U.N. more than all of the countries put together. No one can reign in Israel. But the UN itself, it was set up by the same psychopathic groups from the very first, with land donated by the Rockefellers. The UN isn't an international body concerned with the preservation of the planet or humankind or justice on this earth. They're part of the problem. They're just further psychopaths wanting to impoverish the people of the world. So in my book, it kind of tells the story a little bit of what happened to my sweetheart Karen and I, who died this year, and kind of what happened to us, kind of waking up to it all and realizing the extent of the depravity and realizing what was happening on our planet. And in a way, it's horrifying. And we went through a lot, especially in the early stages. We had one period where we experienced states of rapture and bliss. It was like we were learning all these truths about things, and we both experienced these states of rapture and bliss and illumination and very mystical experiences we experienced at a certain point. And it also led to fearfulness and dread at different times, because you wake up and it's crazy. You realize and you try to say anything about it, and we became fearful ourselves that we would be victims of these people. And just as people in the truth networks, you know, have reason to be fearful, especially with all this new legislation in the United States where they can imprison anyone, anywhere, anytime for anything, and they don't have to have any evidence, and you have no recourse, you don't even know the charges against you. They can just do anything they want. It's complete lawlessness and violation of international law, Geneva Conventions, American law, Canadian law. It's just complete criminality on an international level. And now this criminality could lead us into a major world war if Israel attacks Iran. Because Iran's not going to just roll over and play passive, and I don't see why they should. Iran's never attacked any other nation in hundreds of years, even though the Americans have helped overthrow their government and started wars against Iran repeatedly. And yet we call the Iranians the terrorists. You see, it's so funny. We are the terrorists, meaning the Western nations. We have become the terrorists. We terrorized the people in Libya, carried out a criminal war, led to the murders of tens of thousands of people, the destruction of a country, one of the most progressive countries in the world, really, what Gaddafi had done in Libya. And all your media has to do is just tell you new lies about how Gaddafi is massacring his people. And so we're going to save them. Yeah, we're going to spread democracy now. We spread democracy in Libya. Eh? You spread it to Iraq. You dropped it on them from the air. Murdered tens and 2 million people in the Middle East. Murdered in these wars. And now the United States fights terrorism by drone attacks anywhere. Kill people in Pakistan, kill people in Somalia, kill people in Libya. We're killing people all over the world, mass murdering people. And you're fighting terror. Oh, you don't recognize you're the terrorist. You're fight the terrorism, do you? Oh, that's very clever. Hey, aren't you glad we got the American forces fighting terrorism for us? Oh, yeah, yeah, for sure. I hope you get Osama bin Laden and his reindeer real soon. See, next time they'll tell you it's Bugs Bunny. Bugs Bunny and Iranian terrorists who do something. And then we'll have reason to destroy the people of Iran. It's so insane. You know, it breaks my heart when just Karen and I, we woke up to it all. It just, it was very stressful. It's like we were people who still had some moral sense, you know, like thou shalt not kill. Like, you know, can't we just let people live in peace? And, you know, we were never prejudiced against any people. We don't care what color anyone is or what religion you is. We respected all races and people. We thought the UN like embodied such noble ideals. We thought our police stood up for such ideals and our politicians. And you just realize they're all pathological liars. And none of them have the parts to stand up to the real beast of our time. We're facing very serious problems ahead. And I don't think, some people think, oh, you know, what can we do to survive? We've got to have enough food in the house. And if we do this or that, we can protect ourselves against radiation with these nutrients. And we can do this and that to try to fight off the global elite. And we're always on the defensive. Like, how do we try to save ourselves and save our country and children from these psychopaths? How do we do it? We're always on the defense. So when Karen and I woke up at a certain point, I felt I had the revelations, and I felt the, in a way it was, I wrote this kind of poetry. You can see it up on my website. I put up on my website the revelations that occurred to me back in 2006. And that kind of led to the writing of this new book I have, and has my revelations in it, and then it has whole sections on it's called Crimes Against Humanity, and it covers 9/11 and Oh Canada Lost, how Canada's been sold out, Masters of Deceit and Propaganda, all about the media, UN Agenda 21 for population reduction. It has Masters of Poisoning, Sickness and Starvation with articles on chemtrails, inoculations, fluoridation, GM foods, healthcare regulations, all the criminal crimes being perpetrated against us as Canadian and American and world citizens. All these crimes being perpetrated by our governments and the corporate elites. And I have some bigger chapters on the criminal poisoning of the citizens of Ottawa and Kempville through chemtrail poisoning. And that's based on some videos I'm making on the chemtrail poisoning of citizens. And then I do reviews of a number of conspiracy libraries. And I review Illuminati by Henry Mackow and Human Race, Get Off Your Knees by David Icke and the Conspirator's Handbook. And I end up with a review of Tex Mar's Conspiracy of the Six-Pointed Star, which, of course, is the Star of David. And Tex Mar is a fundamentalist Christian, and he sees the world situation in terms of biblical revelation. Sorry. And the Synagogue of Satan is this kind of Zionist Nazi New World Order that's been brought in upon us. So I have a whole section on the crimes against humanity. Then I have a whole section on fabled airplanes, which is my analysis of how there were no airplanes on 9/11, only faked witnesses and very poorly done media composites. And then I have a whole section on human psychopathology and the causes of war, which is based on my book on Gurdjieff, looking at human psychopathology. What is it about humans that we can do such horrendous things to other people? And Gurdjieff talks about what he calls husnumuses, who are people who lack what he calls the divine impulse of conscience. These people lack normal feeling function. Okay, related to the heart and to the experience of conscience. See, these people, imagine imagine being able to go down the street and have a little can in your hands, like can like spray paint. Imagine going down the street and spraying everybody you see with poison. So suppose you could put poisons in this can. You could go down the street and spray people with poisons. Okay, and suppose you put aluminum, strontium, and barium in your can. You could spray people with poisons. Okay, now most people wouldn't want to do that because they're not psychopaths. And they wouldn't want to hurt someone. They would never do something like that to a child. Like, you can't imagine doing it, you see. But when people do it up in the air, and they have whole fleets of airplanes that spray us with poisons from the toxic poisons from the air, now estimated 10 to 20 million tons of these poisons sprayed on us from the air, that's perfectly fine. But those poisons will make us sick. Oh, and then we'll have to be on pharmaceutical drugs. Oh, they own the pharmaceutical companies too, do they? Oh, or we'll get Alzheimer's and we'll have to go to an old age home. Oh, they're building old age homes for us, are they? Oh, how nice of them. See, these people are psychopaths. They lack the divine impulse of conscience. There's something damaged. They're crippled in the heart. Not like a person who's physically crippled. These people are emotionally, spiritually crippled. They're soulless. They have a crystallized narcissism and egoism that forms this false self in them. So my book has a whole section on Gurdjieff's views of war. And then it comes to the zero-point proposal, which is my proposal for the worldwide prosecution of the criminal elites for their crimes against humanity. And this next year, I'm going to be trying to promote this more, this concept more and more, that what we have to do, there has to be a restoration of international law in our societies. And the only way that can be done is to seize the assets of these elite classes under the anti-terrorist legislation which exists now. And if this could be done worldwide, you would eliminate all the debts of all the countries on earth, and you would put these characters, all these so-called elites, you'd put them in their own special FEMA camps together for intercourse among themselves, and they can have new pet dogs and inoculations and chemtrails and GMO foods. Will take good care of them. And humankind as a race, we're going to move ahead into a new age. We're going to bring out all the inventions that they've hidden. And people are going to learn about the true history of what's been going on in our society for the past 50 years. And when my revelations occurred back in 2006, somehow I felt that I had to get through to 212. If I wanted to live, I had to make it to 212. And to me, and I don't know, you know, my revelations, I look at them. I thought in my revelations, I felt this is going to happen. These elites are going to end up in their FEMA camps, in the hells of their own design, because this is going to turn on them. And I feel this has to, we have to turn this situation around on these elites and reestablish the principles of law and righteousness in our nations. And we need to do that this year. We can't just allow the destruction of our nations, our countrymen, and the earth to proceed as it has. Thank you, BBS Radio. This has been Christopher Holmes at Zero Point Show. Mystic psychologist, forensic psychologist. I think this is a very interesting book, hopefully inspirational to people. 1137, the last chapter in the book, explains some of the magic of the number 1137. It's my answer to 9/11. My answer to that is 1137. Thank you, BBS Radio. We'll be back in 2 weeks. Remember yourself, visit www.zeropoint.ca. Thank you, Don and Doug and Seth at BBS Radio. Goodbye.